Welcome to this installment of Witness to Yesterday, the podcast of the Champlain Society. My name is Nicole O'Byrne, and I'm a legal historian at the Faculty of Law, University of New Brunswick, which is located on the unceded and unsurrendered land of the Wolastoqiyik. Today, I will be interviewing Sean Carleton about his book, Lessons in Legitimacy, Colonialism, Capitalism, and the Rise of State Schooling in British Columbia, published by UBC Press in 2022. The book is the Clio Prize winner in 2023 for the best book on British Columbia history. Sean Carleton is an assistant professor in the Department of History and Indigenous Studies at the University of Manitoba. He earned his PhD at the Frost Center for Canadian Studies at Trent University. Sean is an associate of the L.R. Wilson Institute for Canadian History and a contributor to Active History. He's also a founding member of the Graphic History Collective. Sean, thank you so much for joining us today on Witness to Yesterday.
Thanks for having me, Nicole. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Before we get to your book, I'd like to ask you about your involvement with Active History and the Graphic History Collective. How do these initiatives reflect the evolution of historical studies in Canada?
Right. Well, I guess part of my historical practice has always been a deep commitment to the work of being a public intellectual. And many of my favorite historians, from E.B. Thompson to C.L.R. James to Adele Perry and Brittany Luby, all focus, I think, in their work on helping people understand the lessons of the past, but in ways that are useful in the present, and have stuck their neck out in different ways at different times to be engaged in the public-facing work of being a historian in difficult times. So I think, you know, that is an important part of the work that I do. And I know E.P. Thompson always used to say that the work of being a public intellectual sometimes felt like standing on a very narrow ledge watching the tides come up. But he persisted anyway because he was convinced that the objective of his work, his intellectual labor, was not just to understand the world, but to change it for the better. And for me, that's part of my focus. And so I think my commitment to public history, be that working with Active History or making comic books and graphic novels with the Graphic History Collective, it's all about making history accessible and ensuring that it can be a resource for people trying to make the world a better place. So that's, to me, part of the power of history.
Now let's get to your book. You start by mentioning the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which reported in 2015. How did the recommendations in the TRC report influence your approach to this book?
Well, as a settler scholar, as a non-Indigenous historian, I acknowledge that positioning oneself is an important element of Indigenous methodology, and being clear about your intentions and thinking about how your work benefits Indigenous people is the key part of that work. And in historical work, that can sometimes be a bit tricky. But as I explain in the book's preface, although I am a non-Indigenous person, I have a residential school survivor in my family, Patrick, who attended the St. Michael's Indian Residential School in Alert Bay in British Columbia. And I watched him go through the Truth and Reconciliation process, which was quite difficult and very eye-opening. And I made a promise after he went through that process to learn more about the history of colonialism and schooling and sharing and to share it with other non-Indigenous people so that no more generations of settlers like me could grow up and have the excuse of, I didn't learn this, or I didn't know this was happening. I grew up in North Vancouver, in the shadow of the St. Paul's Residential School on Squamish territory, and I didn't know how it was affecting my Squamish neighbors. I didn't even know what, you know, that was a residential school, and so I wanted to play a small role in changing that. And I made a promise that I would work to help put truth before reconciliation, as the TRC called for. So there's that element, I think, of reciprocity and relationality in my work that's important to acknowledge right up front to the reader to help them understand my position and why I'm taking on the work, which is why I root the book in a response to this TRC. And I also do this to help explain that I too am a product of schooling in British Columbia, right? And to position settler making as a key role of public education, to make it clear to the reader from the beginning that the book is about the intertwined and overlapping history of schooling for Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples, and how all of this plays a role in the making of British Columbia as a settler capitalist society.
The phrase "ruling by schooling" informs the main title of the book, Lessons in Legitimacy. How did the educational system in British Columbia justify its colonial project?
The main title combines ideas from two key works that really helped me frame and contextualize the project. So the first is anti-colonial theorist Albert Memmi's book, The Colonizer and the Colonized, which I recommend for listeners if they haven't checked it out. And in that, he argues that colonial societies are always in a crisis of legitimacy. And this idea really kind of stuck with me. He says, quote, "It is impossible for colonizers not to be aware of the constant illegitimacy of their status." He explains, in order for the colonizer to be the complete master, it is not enough for him to be so in actual fact. He must believe in his legitimacy. And so as a result, colonizers, particularly those who possess the most socioeconomic political power, develop various techniques of rule to legitimize colonial hegemony. And schooling is one such technique. And the other part of the title draws on schooling history literature, right? So we've got anti-colonial kind of theory, but also schooling history, historiography, that looks at the process of ruling by schooling. This is, I'm especially influenced by M. Kazem Bakus's book about schooling and colonialism in the West Indies. And this, he called his book Education As and For Legitimacy. And so I put these kind of two concepts into conversation with one another to really focus on how schooling in British Columbia developed as part of this process of learning legitimacy. So that's, I think, the book's title, a nod, I think, to some of the key works that I'm drawing on, but also I think as an easy way into thinking about the book's central argument, that schooling for Indigenous and non-Indigenous children had a hidden curriculum, or what I call the lessons in legitimacy, the formal and informal teachings that justified the colonial project and normalized the unequal social relations of settler capitalism as commonsensical, as something to be accepted, right? So schooling, I argue, in short, served as an important laboratory for learning colonial legitimacy throughout much of the British Empire in the late 19th and early 20th century. And the book looks specifically at this process in Canada and in British Columbia in particular.
How does your book unsettle the conventions of education history in Canada?
Yeah, well, as I explain in the beginning of the book, the historiography on education in Canada often treats schooling for Indigenous and non-Indigenous children as completely separate fields and subjects. You could have whole people writing books about Indigenous education and, you know, a whole field looking at public schools for non-Indigenous children. But often these two kinds of historiography don't overlap. But the history does. That's the thing. So though researchers unconsciously reproduce this kind of approach as they follow scholarly convention and archival ordering, right? Provincial public schools and federal and church-run day schools and residential schools often have separate archival collections. So historians go and they consult those collections and they write up their histories separately. But the result of that is that most historians strictly adhere to official policy lines, right, that try to keep these systems separate, when in practice, they were actually blurred, broken, and challenged in everyday educational life. And British Columbia's public schools, for example, as I show throughout the book and as actually the cover image that I've chosen for the book is from the South Fort George School public school that had a lot of Indigenous children attending in the early 20th century, right? I'm like literally trying to show how the way that we conceptualize this history assumes a binary that at times didn't necessarily exist. And so I show throughout the book that public schools in British Columbia often accommodated settler and Indigenous children, and in larger numbers than has previously been understood, and over a longer period of time. They weren't necessarily just exceptions. They were permanent parts of that history over an 80-year time period. And I also argue that it's not just about Indigenous children finding their way into public schools that challenges this kind of historiographical division. But the systems themselves need to be understood as being more interconnected than researchers have previously understood. And by looking at these histories as overlapping rather than separate, I argue that new insights can be found. And on this, as an example, okay, individuals frequently moved between educational spheres. So residential school principals sat on public school boards. Their students became teachers in day and residential schools, and public school graduates also taught in day and residential schools. Another just example as a case in point, during his career, R.H. Carnes served as a public school teacher first, then became the principal of the Kokolitsa Indian Residential School in the Fraser Valley, and then became the Department of Indian Affairs school inspector for British Columbia. So I think the complexities of colonial education can be brought into sharper focus when these two streams of schooling for Indigenous and non-Indigenous people are considered together. And this is a different way of approaching education history that I borrow from people like Jean Barman, who's a influential BC historian, and I use to present in the book, and one that I hope will help more non-Indigenous people start to challenge their own sort of conceptions of, I often hear from people, okay, residential schools and day schools are about colonialism and they're bad and they're now over, but now everybody gets to go to public schools, so everything is good, right? And I think that I'm hoping that part of the book will challenge this idea that public schooling has nothing to do with settler colonialism. In fact, we need to understand these different kinds of schooling as part of that project of rule over time. And it then, I think, asks some more difficult questions about how does public schooling continue to play a role in the facilitation of a settler capitalist society like Canada still very much is. And I think that is something that I was hoping to help people understand historically so that we can be asking different questions today in the present about education and its role in moving us forward.
Well, in my opinion, one of the real strengths of the book is that you show the interconnectedness of the Indigenous and non-Indigenous experience in British Columbia, and then you place the historical figures into that complex milieu because it was not separate or segregated. So in the book, you explore the role of James Douglas in the history of education in the province. There's a good example of someone operating in a very complex environment. Could you explain his role in setting up schools in British Columbia?
Yeah, I mean, I think James Douglas, given his stature and influence over the development, at least of early British Columbia, is a good case in point here. And I would say borrowing on the work of my University of Manitoba colleague, Adele Perry, who's written an excellent book about James Douglas, what I wanted to do is add to the knowledge about him in ways that focus on how his interest in colonial statecraft intersected with his interest in schooling policy, which doesn't get as much attention in the historiography. So in short, Douglas, whose wife was Cree, and he has Indigenous children. It's a very fluid and flexible fur trading environment in British Columbia at that particular time. He saw public schooling as a way of attracting and retaining colonists to the isolated British colonies of Vancouver Island and British Columbia in 1850s and 1860s. So we talk about Douglas in terms of his kind of state building, but we sometimes forget that part of that state building was also building up public schooling. And try as a way of helping a permanent settler population take root after the gold rush, right? In order to attract and retain families and youth who are key to set what is often talked about as settler futurity or the future of any settler colony. And my colleague Laura Ishiguro has emphasized this in the context of BC history, right? Thinking about what do you need for a settler colony to continue, right, into the future. And that emphasis on youth and a corollary of that is often a focus on education. Using schooling as an incentive to build society. So Douglas begins to mobilize public opinion and limited state resources at first in the service of schooling to help build the colony. And this part of Douglas's legacy is lesser known. But he also, okay, so he's involved in sort of helping public education get up off the ground. But he also offers state assistance to missionaries of different Christian denominations, despite himself being an Anglican, to support educational efforts amongst Indigenous peoples on the West Coast as a kind of soft method of colonization, as a way of trying to slowly win them over. Over time, to assimilate them as a way of bringing them on board with colonization, to alleviate the fear that Indigenous nations would rise up, resist, and snuff out the colony, right? Which was a constant fear, particularly in that early 1850s, 1860s period. So Douglas himself, realizing that colonizers were playing with fire by essentially asserting British sovereignty and stealing land, often referred to Indigenous settler relations at mid-century as a smoldering volcano. And his hope was that by supporting missionaries interested in running schools for Indigenous people, even if only modestly at first, would prevent a calamitous eruption of this smoldering volcano and thereby bolster colonial security on the West Coast. So he's, as governor and then... as a prominent politician out in Victoria, he helped support the establishment of what was called common schools, which then become public schools for non-Indigenous people. Although the boundaries of that were complicated because he would often send his own children there. So our idea that even common schools were just for white children, whereas mission schools were just for Indigenous children. Again, those binaries, I try and set them up and then complicate them throughout the book to show how we really need to complicate our understanding of the emergence of schooling. But Douglas plays a really important role in building up both of those different streams.
Well, many of our listeners will appreciate that British Columbia has a colorful political history. You introduce us to a number of fascinating characters, such as Premier Amor de Cosmos, literally lover of the universe. What was the provincial government's approach to Indigenous and non-Indigenous education in that period after James Douglas?
Right. Well, colorful is one way to put it. Aggressively racist and belligerent to Indigenous people is perhaps another, maybe more historically accurate way of seeing it. And I mean, you know, this is the thing about many of these figures. You know, Amor de Cosmos is not his real name. He changes it to lover of the universe. And yet, you know, he was a lover of the universe, but he did not like Indigenous people at all. He was, you know, very belligerent and racist. And was very much committed to trying to erase and replace Indigenous people as part of the shift from, you know, what is now known as British Columbia, from an Indigenous place to a non-Indigenous settler colony. And I mean, it's interesting because I think a lot of people, perhaps listeners outside of British Columbia who are listening, might think of British Columbia, right, as that sort of hippy-dippy, progressive, tolerant place. But in reality, its origins are far from that sort of mythical perception of it being a tolerant place. many of the key figures pushing for British Columbia to join Canadian Confederation, right? James Douglas is part of this earlier history of the Hudson's Bay Company and its transition into a British colony. But the transition from the British colony into a Canadian province is pushed by a number of people, including Joseph Trutch, Amor de Cosmos, people like Israel Wood Powell, right? And interestingly, all of these folks are school promoters or interested in and very much firmly believe in the power of public schooling to help build British Columbia into a prosperous province. But they also don't like Indigenous people. Like, these are the things that they have in common. They're pro-Canadian Confederation. They really believe in the power of public education. And, they hold very terrible views regarding Indigenous people. They understand that they are barriers to their own prosperity. So just to give you an example, someone like Israel Wood Powell, right? He could be a promoter for public schools in the province, which people think, oh, public schooling is a good thing. But he thought of public schooling very narrowly as a way of building up settlers, of giving them power, right? And then he becomes the superintendent of Indian Affairs for British Columbia, where he advocates for residential schools to be expanded to the West Coast to help undercut and destroy Indigenous lifeways to facilitate settler capitalism more easily. So in this way, you can see how these different kinds of schooling for Indigenous and non-Indigenous people played a kind of dual role. For Indigenous people, schooling was meant to delegitimize Indigenous ways of life. And public schooling was meant to legitimize settler futurity as a kind of commonsensical process, as one of replacement over time, of building up the power of the settler colony. And a lot of these key figures, Trutch, Amor de Cosmos, Powell, right, are key figures. They're often celebrated figures as people who helped build British Columbia, the architects of building British Columbia as a province. And yet they were doing so on a foundation of settler colonial genocide, and often supporting schooling as a part of that.
Missionaries and mission schools also played an important role in the history of education in BC. Can you explain their role and how it evolved? And I'm particularly interested in learning more about the early missionary Herbert Beaver and the evolution of non-sectarian education.
As I already alluded to, we really need to understand both church and state working together, and colonialism and capitalism as being enmeshed in interconnected processes, as working together. And we see how at different times, state power, whether we're talking about colonial, like the colonies, or provincial or federal state power, right, they broker deals with religious officials to play roles in schooling, because schooling costs money. So there are at times where they are inviting the church to play a role to meet some of that kind of financial commitment. So be it Herbert Beaver, right? He was a church missionary society missionary who comes out to the West Coast to start one of the first schools at Fort Vancouver in the 1830s, right? And he's upset with this kind of fluid and racially heterogeneous fur trade society that he encounters. He's not in favor of people like James Douglas taking Indigenous wives. He's very upset about this kind of environment. But nevertheless, he comes out and he plays the role as a school teacher. Or we look at some of the other early examples, right? The first Catholic missionaries, right, who strike deals with the colonial government to establish one of the first residential schools in the country in the 1850s at what is today Mission City on the Fraser River. Or you have that official church-state partnership that develops in the 1880s and 1890s that is really building on these earlier examples of sort of church-state partnership. It doesn't come out of nowhere. And in fact, sometimes the historiography thinks of that church-state partnership developing more in Ontario, but part of the book is kind of challenging the direction of that and actually showing how that state-church partnership also is very evident in the early examples in British Columbia. And you have people, including a church missionary society, lay priest William Duncan, who actually travels to Ottawa to, this is before the residential school system gets set up, so this is in the 1870s, to talk about his boarding school for Indigenous people that was founded with money from the colonial government. So you start to see how these colonial officials constantly called on church officials to play roles in setting up Canada as a settler capitalist and overtly Christian country. And even in terms of public schooling, okay, so I think most listeners will understand that, you know, the residential and day school systems had a religious component. That's fairly easy to understand. But in terms of public schooling, especially on the West Coast, where the provincial government mandates non-sectarian education to avoid some of the conflicts about schooling and religion that had bubbled up in other places. You know, it was still, though, overtly Christian in very overt ways, from reading the Bible to singing hymns and prayers. So it was non-denominational, but it was also overtly Christian. And so I think in this way, part of the book helps us understand that religion and schooling for Indigenous and non-Indigenous people went hand in hand. It was different, but there were overlapping themes, and the church is a constant figure in much of the schooling conversation from the 1840s to when the book ends in the 1930s. And it does continue in different ways afterwards as well.
Well, like a lot of books that deal with settler colonialism, there are a lot of emotionally charged stories. You do not shy away from some of them in your narrative. Can you tell us about Johnny Sticks and his son Duncan? And how did the government bureaucracy respond to that particular situation?
Right. Yeah. This is a difficult story, to be sure. So for listeners out there, I'll try and talk a little bit about the story and hold some space for, I think, the difficult truths it reveals, but I'll try and do so in a mindful way. So if you're sitting there making dinner, you know, you can, if you're interested in learning more, you can read the full account in the book or reach out if you're interested. But I start off chapter six by recounting this story of Duncan Sticks, an 8-year-old Sequimic boy whose father, Johnny Sticks, finds dead in a ditch at the side of a road in interior British Columbia in February of 1902. And a few days earlier, Duncan and a number of his classmates had run away from the St. Joseph's Catholic residential school located in Williams Lake, again in the interior of the province. And his father, Duncan's father, was obviously upset, but he was also frustrated because this was not the first time that Duncan had run away from the school. In fact, the previous year, Duncan had fled the school, and when he got home, he complained to his father that he was being underfed and physically abused. And the hard part about this is that his father didn't really want him to miss out on an education. And so reluctantly, he returns his son to the school, though he checks in on him in the summer to make sure that he's doing well and everything seems to be better. But unfortunately, the next time that Johnny sees his son is when he finds his dead body in the snow. And this is just one of the many difficult stories I share in the book as trying to be as mindful about trying to ensure that I share these stories openly reported in the Department of Indian Affairs records. Right, that need to be told, but I try and balance the kind of pain and hurt, try and avoid sort of a damage-centered approach of understanding this as Indigenous scholars such as Eve Tuck have sort of talked about moving away from. And I try and balance this with also a sort of emphasis on the continual organizing and resistance that often accompanied this horror. And I think the Sticks, the Johnny and Duncan Stick example here is interesting because, so after this, Johnny organizes with other parents to demand an inquiry. And at the hearings, students and parents talked about the poor conditions and abuse happening at the schools. If you read the testimony, it's very clear the problems at this school very early on. But of course, what is unfortunate is that the school officials essentially deny any wrongdoing. And the colonial officials ultimately side with the church officials and allow the school to continue with minor changes. And we see this cycle repeated over and over again in horrifying ways. So that I think part of the contribution of the book is showing how it's not that no one knew what was going on, right? They didn't know about the hurt and pain and even death that was openly happening at these schools. It's more actually that the power imbalance meant that nothing was done about it, right? That Indigenous children were treated as collateral damage in the process of Canadian nation building. And I think that's truly a horrific point. So in many ways, I think the book shows how these examples show how genocide proceeded in fairly banal and even at times indifferent ways, and how schooling played a key role in that. And I think that asks some difficult questions about how we reconcile, how we reckon with that history. It's easy to say, well, we didn't know it was bad. Now we know it's bad and we're moving forward. But I mean, this is 1902. This is very early on in the system. British Columbia's first residential school doesn't come online until 1889. So this was within the first decade that the system was operating, and its full horrors were there very clearly. And officials basically get presented with the full evidence of that, and yet they double down on the system. They defend the church and school officials. And so I think that part of the narrative offers some more complicated questions for us to grapple with in the present.
Well, as you point out in the book, responding to the truth and reconciliation calls to action is really predicated on a better understanding of the truth. And your book goes a long way to making that argument that there's more complexity behind this story than maybe we've originally appreciated. So for a last question here, in the conclusion, you write, and I'll quote, "British Columbia may be a province, but its history is not provincial." Can you explain how your book explores larger historical themes and brings things together?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think anyone that's written a book out there knows that writing a conclusion is one of the harder parts. How do you conclude something that, of course, you know, for me, I understand that the relationship between colonialism, capitalism, and schooling doesn't end in 1930. You know, that's part of what I say in the book's intro and conclusion. And so it was hard to kind of think about how do you end something that is ongoing, right? How do you put that? And what I decided to do, you know, especially for a subject like this, where a lot is changing, there's a lot of public attention on the understandings that the book is based on. Essentially, what I decided to do was draw out a handful of what I thought were key lessons that the book has for us. And I think one of them, as you've alluded to here in the question, is that while the book is focused on British Columbia, I think readers will be interested in the transnational and transimperial connections that I constantly try to strive to make throughout the book. So in short, it's a book about BC, but it's not just about BC. So as I highlight, government officials drew on examples in Britain and its global empire to devise, deploy, and defend various kinds of schooling as a technique of colonial rule and legitimacy. So here I'm trying to perhaps invite listeners who are maybe not interested in schooling history or BC history to see this project as something that has a broader appeal. So I explain in the book that gunboats and militias and police and land surveyors, of course, we know play important roles in colonization. But I think we need to grapple with the reality that schools also play important roles as laboratories for learning legitimacy. Colonial officials, missionaries, and teachers traveled out from Britain and its other colonies, bringing their ideas and experiences with them as they sought to shape education in British Columbia. As an example, Indian boarding schools were influenced by manual labor schools for Native Americans in the U.S. There's a kind of overlapping history there. Government officials drew on ideas from a trans-imperial network to implement school reforms during the early 1900s. The emphasis on manual training, manual labor, teaching people to work in an increasingly industrial society. Many of these ideas are borrowed from a much larger environment. It's not just homegrown ideas. Educational officials are drawing on educational ideas from around Europe and around the British Empire. And I think why this is important, and it's one of the key ideas I come back to highlighting in the conclusion, sort of, opening it up to thinking about the broader connections, is that I think this is helpful because it challenges readers to see that British Columbia is really just operating here as one node in the larger British Empire, right? So kind of moving away from thinking of British Columbia as somehow exceptional. And I think this is important, understanding in its larger context, because it reminds us, as people today grapple with global histories of colonization and enslavement, that our pasts have always been intertwined, and that our reckonings with their histories in the present must also be connected. And that our success in this regard is imperative for our shared future together on this planet. So it's trying to break down some of the kind of narrow ways that we often understand certain kinds of history, certain histories of region, and trying to understand the larger process that's going on, and thinking about these as being interconnected in a trans-imperial way. And hopefully that invites scholars, not just in BC or in Canada or the United States, but other areas, to understand the ways in which schooling history and settler colonialism can be thought of as being a sort of interconnected global process. And that will open up inevitably new lines of scholarly inquiry and ways for us to grapple with a changing world today.
Sean, thank you so much for talking to us today about your book, a most deserving winner of the prestigious Canadian Historical Association's Clio Prize.
Thanks for having me, Nicole.
My guest today has been Sean Carleton. He's the author of Lessons in Legitimacy, Colonialism, Capitalism, and the Rise of State Schooling in British Columbia, published by UBC Press in 2022. You've been listening to Witness to Yesterday. Please visit our website at www.champlainsociety.ca, where you can learn more about the work that we do. And please feel free to follow us on social media. We always appreciate likes and shares. This podcast is made possible by the members of the Champlain Society, who work hard to bring to life original documents in Canadian history. We would like to thank the L.R. Wilson Institute of History at McMaster University, as well as a consortium of Canadian scholarly book publishers that includes University of Toronto Press, UBC Press, McGill Queen's University Press, the University of Regina Press, and the University of Ottawa Press. My name is Nicole O'Byrne. This interview was recorded on March 19th, 2024. It was produced by Jessica Schmidt and supported by the University of Toronto Press Journal team.